The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Barry Roth. Mr. Roth joined the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, in 1999. He became a board member of the Colorado chapter in 2001. He is currently the treasurer, public relations director, and historical education specialist. Mr. Roth has been interested in the subject of unidentified flying objects since he was 15 years old. He read about an incident that had occurred off the coast of Newfoundland, Canada, in which a large disc-shaped object had flown rapidly toward a military transport plane. Since then, he has been a passionate researcher and has read hundreds of books on the UFO, UAP subject. He was later appointed as public information officer of MUFON from 2009 to 2012. Barry was tasked with putting together an information and education program on the history of ufology, and he recently published a book entitled A Brief History of Ufology from 1941 to 2011. The majority of these events involve military, law enforcement, multiple witness sightings, and physical trace evidence. And we're happy to have him with us today. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Well, thanks, David. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And I think that going back in history, let's say, I think most people cite the Roswell crash as the beginning of the modern UFO era. But that's not really the case, is it?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of events that occurred before. Now, Roswell's the most known. I mean, it's the one place you can say Roswell, and everybody, pretty much the majority of the population, thinks UFOs. Once you get outside of Roswell, even when I speak to different groups, most of the cases that I talk about that I think are pretty notorious, most people haven't heard of. There's a few out there, but for the most part, people aren't as educated as would be allowed if the mainstream media or a public education system got involved with teaching people about the history of ufology and what occurred really starting from the Foo Fighters in the early 40s forward.
Okay. And the Foo Fighters, for the benefit of our audience that are not familiar with that, tell us what the Foo Fighters were.
Well, I'm not talking about the band, though I am a big fan of David Grohl and his band, and they put on a heck of a show. But the Foo Fighters were basically in the early 40s, during World War II, there were orbs of light that were seen by both Allied and Axis powers, in which the Americans and the British were thinking that they were enemy scientific experiments from Germany or Japan. And then the Axis powers, Germany, Japan, thought that they were American or British experimental balls of light. And they were seen basically typically flying, usually in groups of two or more, flying off the wingtips of their planes, and at times flying through their planes, sometimes causing a brief stuttering of the engine. But they moved around fairly quickly. They were fired upon at times. There was a Polish pilot back in 1941 that was shot with 50 caliber rounds, and it had absolutely no impact whatsoever on the orbs of light. They would move anywhere from basically the speed of the plane to much greater flight patterns. You're talking radar back then was pretty minimal and archaic, but still, I mean, they were probably flying about maybe 900 miles per hour. We didn't have anything at the time that could fly that fast. So it was a mystery. It was never resolved. It was a big part. It led to Leonard Stringfield becoming a ufologist, a great researcher, because he had an event that occurred while he was on board a flight. I think he was navigator on one of the World War II flights towards the end of the war. And he saw a few teardrop-shaped discs. They had no idea what they were, and then they disappeared. And that kind of piqued his interest. So, when I started my book, there was a lot of different places I could start, but I thought starting with Foo Fighters, more of modern history, what I would say, moving forward would make the most amount of sense in the general education. I looked at, what are the most credible pieces of information that are out there? And they're basically multiple witness, military, law enforcement, physical trace evidence, and, mass witness sightings out there where, you really... With the when you have two or more people, and a lot of my events that I talk about in the book are hundreds of people or thousands of people, were they all hallucinating at the same time? My favorite really events are the ones that have not just good credible visual sightings, but also airborne and ground radar evidence too.
Right. More evidence. Now, when you talk about the Foo Fighters, and you talk about them balls of light that went through a plane, it really doesn't sound like a physical object. Is it possible that it's ball lightning or something like that?
Well, I mean, they were occurring, these balls of light were first of all occurring in all sorts of atmospheric conditions. So it didn't have to be rainy out. It didn't have to be stormy. It was just could be on a clear night when it occurred, where there'd be no reason for ball lightning to occur. And let me just say, ball lightning is an extremely rare event. A lot of things have to come into play. Balls are typically, and when it does happen, the rare time, they're about the size of a grapefruit or basketball, and they bounce. It moves in a very bouncy pattern. And they're very short-lived. They might last for seconds, maybe 10 seconds. These balls of light were, being seen for a great length of time, 5-10 minutes. Ball lightning couldn't last that long. So that would be pretty much ruled out.
We had Mr. Paul Blake Smith on the show a couple of years ago, actually. We discussed his book on the alleged UFO crash in 1941 near Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And can I assume that that's one of the accounts with which you began your book?
I did not. It's a questionable event. It very well could have occurred. I decided to not include that in the book. I know basically the witness was if I remember correctly, was the wife of the priest that gave last rites to the entities on the ground. And it was her deathbed kind of confession to her daughter about this event that occurred. So you really only had a single witness, in this case, giving anecdotal evidence. And I focused more on multiple witnesses. Or if it was a single witness, something that was evidentiary, like a physical trace evidence.
Mm-hmm. So it's still up in the air, as we, pun intended.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of military intrusions involving UFOs. have been the subject of great interest of late. Would you give us a couple examples of these?
Well, I mean, you've got, from a military intrusion standpoint, I mean, first of all, you could, you could talk about Roswell on there and then what happened. I say not so much the military intrusion of the evidence came back to an Army airfield, but one of the probably the ones that are more notorious would be Malmstrom Air Force Base intrusion in 1967. It's a great book that was written about it by Robert Salas, who was one of the main characters in this event, called Fated Giant, in which he's in a silo. There were two events that occurred at Malmstrom in 67, which is in an Air Force base in Montana near Great Falls. And they were 8 days apart. It occurred in March of 67. And I'm going to start with the second event, which was with the one that Robert Salas was involved in, which he's 60 feet underground with his lieutenant. He gets a call on the radio from the SAT team up there, the security alert team, that there's some giant glowing, there's lights in the sky that are moving around. And he's not sure if this guy's serious or not. And he thought that would be really unusual for an NCO of the SAT team to be joking around like that. He's like, look, if anything else happens, call and let me know. And he hangs up. And about 10 seconds later, he gets a call back saying there is a giant red glowing object hovering over one of the missile flights, because these flights were all nuclear armed missiles that were designed to be a counterattack if we were ever bombed with nuclear missiles. There was quite a few flights that were there at Malmstrom. It was a major Air Force base for nuclear weaponized missiles, ICBM missiles. And so he gets a call that this red glowing object is hovering over one of the flights of missiles. And then the guy has to go, one of his airmen got hurt. Turned out the guy was so freaked out, he tried climbing over a barbed wire fence and he injured.
Oh, good Lord.
So he then, after he gets the call, he goes to wake up his lieutenant, Lieutenant Mywald. And all of a sudden, the flights of missiles that were, he was over, which was over at Oscar Flight, they start to go down one by one. When I say go down, they go into a no-go status, which means that they can't be fired and they can't be launched. So they're going offline one by one, which is, of course, a critical intrusion to our security net. Yeah. And eventually the object leaves. And the next day, they contact McDonnell Douglas, that was involved in the installation of the equipment, of the computer system. They send a guy out there, an engineer. He can find absolutely nothing wrong with the systems. Now, the missiles are still offline, and they have to be brought online. So I can tell you, David, that it's unusual enough for one missile to go offline. It happens, but it's kind of unusual. To have 10 in a row go offline is kind of unheard of. To have it happen twice in an eight-day period is almost impossible. The commonality between the two events was a glowing object hovering over the missile flight. The first one occurred 8 days earlier, in which some testing was being done by one of the commanders there at the base. And then he noticed that one missile goes offline, and then three more go offline, and then the rest of the flight goes offline. Once again, lights seen in the sky moving around, and then an object hovering over the actual one of the flights. So to have 20 missiles go offline in 8 days is a near impossible thing to happen. And they tried to duplicate taking the missiles offline. And actually, they were able to duplicate it with a very classified specific noise if it was inserted actually right into the cable line, directly inserted into the cable line. They could shut down the missiles, but it was such a nefarious thing and an unusual thing to do. And there was no evidence anything penetrated the cable lines. So with those missiles going offline, there's no reason why they should have. It was certainly a national security threat.
Yeah,
and it was ironic that in the conduct committee, that one of the reasons why they shut down Project Blue Book, out of the three primary reasons, the first one was no UFOs have ever indicated or showed any kind of national security threat. And the people at Malmstrom would beg to disagree.
So this wasn't a one-off. In other words, you say it happened again and again over an eight.
It's happened at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota in 75, where a large craft was seen. Supposedly about 150 missiles went offline. The opposite happened in 75 at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. According to David Scherr, missileer there, is that there was apparently a craft outside that was doing passive readings of the warheads. Now, the thing was, to go back to Malmstrom, the interesting part was what was affected primarily was the actual was the nuclear targeting systems. In essence, where the nuclear warhead was going to go. These missiles are all pre-programmed of where they're going to go when they're launched. And the actual targeting system was altered. Whether it was done intentionally or unintentionally, it was altered. In the case of Minot, North Dakota, it was as if a craft was reading the actual targeting systems of each missile in the flight, and one of the missiles went into a launch sequence. Now, he didn't do anything to initiate that, but it went to a launch sequence. And there's a variety of ways you can shut down a missile from launching, and you have 15 minutes to do it. And he was able to shut it down. Plus, you can shut down a missile launch from another silo too. Mm-hmm. But he was able to shut that down. And he felt what happened was the craft inadvertently during its reading signal, what's called a PAS signal, inadvertently set one of the missiles into a launch sequence. He shut it down, but he also felt like it was a warning that, hey, we can shut you down or do other things to your missiles when we want. Mm-hmm. Be careful with what you do. That was, you know, a little known event that occurred. You also had the Big Sur event in, I believe, 64, where a missile was launched. David Jacobs was filming it with the latest photographic equipment that was in the world from about 100 miles away. He was actually filming it. Big Sur was being launched from Vandenberg. The fog around that area was notorious. He needed to get up to a higher elevation because this missile was going to go 60 miles up. It was going to deploy over to its specific target, the Pacific. Once again, it was a dummy warhead that was on it. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, he films it, goes up 60 miles, but then eventually the missile goes into a tumbling formation, spirals out of control, and eventually just crashes, misses its target by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles. Later on that evening, he's contacted by a commander at the base saying, hey, can you come into this room? We want to show you the film that you had shot. So he goes into the room. He's sitting down there. There's two guys in civilian clothes, figuring, thinking it's CIA. His commander is there, and his first questions he's asked is, were you messing around with the film? And he said, no. He goes, all right, then I want you to watch this. So they go ahead and show the film, and he's watching it. It's a beautiful launch. It's incredible that it's being filmed so beautifully as it heads up. And by the way, the missile's moving at 11,000 miles per hour. And he's got it nice and steady with this. Once again, state of the art was on this, like, it was on a flatbed truck. I mean, it was really, you know, it was a large, large camera system, mm-hmm. but incredibly accurate and clear. And he's watching it as it's going up. And all of a sudden, another object flies into the picture. And it shines a beam of light on top of the missile and basically hits all the compass points, north, east, south, and west, and then flies out of the picture. Shortly after that, the missile goes into a tumbling motion and ends up crashing into the Pacific Ocean.
I kind of forgot what its mission was, huh?
Yeah. but, well, you talk about, was that a signal message being sent?
Yeah, we can.
You know, we can take your missiles out.
We can.
Loring Air Force Base, and I believe it was 75, another real classic military intrusion that occurred where an object was seen right along the near the flight path of where flights come in to land at the very end of the runway, where object was seen there hovering. It was seen by hundreds and hundreds of personnel, and eventually the object was moving around the base, firing down very thin, you know, laser-sized beams of light in different weapon storage areas, and then took off.
I need to take one moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitcher, your host, and we're speaking with Mr. Barry Roth, investigator and author of the book. Okay, I've lost it now. Brief History of Ufology from 1941 to 2011. So let's get back to Mr. Roth. Now, we were talking about these intrusions on missile bases. Didn't we find out later that after the Cold War that Russia also had the same experiences with UFOs at their missile sites?
They did, and that information is always really tough to come by. You know, you can consider the source, you know, where it's going to be coming from. But yes, they did have a situation where also they had at least one situation where they had a missile shutdown. And allegedly, they also had a situation where they went a launch in progress and they had to shut down the actual you know, weapon, the whole system before the missile could launch. Mm-hmm. So there's supposed to be at least two cases in which this occurred. And you got to figure it probably occurred in China or other countries too, whether it was, once again, message being sent, you know, why would there be missile shutdowns? And at the same time, they've got something on radar, it's flying nearby. In all cases, there was a objects or object nearby that caused the shutdown.
So do you think that, assuming that this is extraterrestrials who know what we're doing, as Stanton Friedman used to say, the kids have found the matches, and they're trying to tell us, do you think they're trying to tell us, you know, we have the ability to shut you down, so don't even try it?
I mean, that's just, once again, that's just a perspective. That's, you know, is that what the message is? It's hard to say. Could it have all been inadvertent? It's possible. But according to people like David Jacobs, David Scherer, their feeling was it was a message being sent, mm-hmm. that we can take out your most destructive weapons if we need to, and you ought to really temper what you're doing, get things more under control. Maybe you need to stop building these things and start putting your R&D into maybe a more productive investment that maybe benefits more people instead of kills them. So, I mean, you know, is that what's happening? I don't know, but if I had to take a, if I had to give my own opinion of that, I would say, yeah, it's possible.
I think the logic tells you that's a great possibility, if not the case. Am I right?
Yeah.
So skeptics always claim that aliens and their crafts are always sighted by some solo farmer out in his field. Actually, there's a plethora of mass witness sightings. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. I would say you've got some, I'll give you three. One, I would say we'd have to go back to is the Phoenix Lights. Mm-hmm. This occurred in March of 97. And it started off, really, it started off in Nevada the day before. And it moved on, but we'll pick it up in the northern Arizona about 7:45 in the evening, where a retired police officer over in up north in north of Phoenix, where he saw an object moving from north to south. It was kind of following the Interstate 17 as it was floating down, and that's just the highway. And it was up hundreds of feet. So he was probably the first notorious sighting. And then as it moved, you had really thousands of witnesses seeing this object with people, very few photographs or video. At the time, I think people were stunned. Maybe the access, you certainly didn't have your smartphones out there. They could just grab their phones and start videoing this mm-hmm. object. They'd have to go inside, get a camera, you know, get a video camera. You probably have VHS to go out there and then start filming it. Maybe there's Sony cams, but 8mm. But at the same time, it would take an effort to go get your 35mm camera or a video camera to start filming. But there were some, and there was a very famous one that was we see where the lights kind of go on as this object is moving down. It seems to be quite large. The object was an estimated size of close to a mile wide, over 5,000 feet. Mm. And it was only flying up hundreds of feet. But some of the sightings were kind of unusual, where there was a systems engineer and his son, who was, I think, an architect, and they were outside. And as the object went by, and by the way, this object is moving about 30 miles per hour. It's about a mile wide. I mean, something that size would have to be flying hundreds of miles an hour to stay aloft.
Yeah.
Aerodynamics. Mm-hmm. You know, their typical jet out there is going to be flying anywhere from 104 to 161 miles an hour to stay aloft. Once it goes below that, based on the size, it'll start, gravity takes over, it'll start coming to the ground. So something moving at 30 miles per hour, unless it's a mile wide balloon of some kind, I don't think it's going to be, staying aloft, at least not by conventional propulsion systems. But he saw this object as it went by the moon. It became transparent. It was like translucent. He could see through it. He could see the moon through it, the stars. And then when it went past the moon, it appeared to be solid again. My opinion is it was probably always translucent. He just recognized it when it went in front of the moon. And then it seemed to become solid again. But it just, there was no backlight at that mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. It's witness after witness of these sightings, and other family saying that, they were the size of it. They had to look in their station wagon. They had to look from one side of the window to the other side, as it was moving over. And eventually the sighting lasted for, I'd say about 2.5 hours, and then it continued heading south. Well, the Air Force came back and they said, it was the Maryland Air National Guard. They were at the Barry Goldwater Gunnery Range, and they were dropping, illumination flares. Well, the Barry Goldwater Gunnery Range is pretty far away from Phoenix. So if they were dropping illumination flares, which they did go out there, I think, as a cover story once they realized it. Mm-hmm. Remember, the first sighting was at 7:45. The Maryland Air National Guard didn't drop their first flare to 10:15 p.m. So what was everything before that? And then on top of that, David, is that it would be at a low angle. You'd be looking at about a 10-degree angle to see these flares. And this object was flying directly overhead of these folks. So not only that, it was silent. And, you got these A-10 Warthogs that were supposedly dropping these flares. They're really loud. Okay? Mm-hmm. Totally silent. Was becoming translucent. Flares also, due to gravity, fall to the ground. These lights were not descending in any way. They also weren't as bright as these illumination flares, which are very bright white. These are more amber colored. So there's all sorts of things you could just cross off the list. But yet, once again, you had thousands of witnesses. And at the time, the governor, Fife Symington, made fun of it by doing a broadcast where he had this fake alien guy comes out wearing a mask. And all the people, the witnesses, were really insulted. He got a lot of blowback as a result. And then later on, he came out and said, I was a witness to it. I saw it. He was actually part of the Stephen Greer, conference he does at the DC Press Club, where he came out and he said, I saw something that was huge and I don't know what it was. So that, that's one case. You also have Stephenville, Texas, where you had thousands of witnesses of an event that occurred in 2008. An object moving anywhere from hundreds of miles an hour to about 2,200 miles per hour. And the great part about that was there was radar tape to support some of this instantaneous acceleration. And great job and shout out to Robert Powell, who actually was involved as he was the chief MUFON investigator for the country at the time. And he FOIA'd the radar tape from it and got it. And it showed there was an object moving. At one point, it was moving at 49 miles per hour and then instantaneously was moving over 600 miles per hour. And then it slowed back down to 59 miles per hour. We don't have anything that could instantaneously take off and slow down. And if we did, wouldn't it be killing all the personnel inside? Imagine going 610 miles per hour and within a second slowing down to 59 miles per hour. How do you the G-forces would kill you.
Yeah, you'd be peeling yourself off the wall.
Yeah, you'd be like a fly on a windshield on that. So going 65 miles per hour and making it. So that was on radar, an object sped up and slowed down within a very short period of time. Lots of witnesses had a little bit of strange cases. One gentleman, said that he saw it. And then the next day he had a lot of black helicopters flying around his house. Ricky, I forgot his last name, but there's plenty of witnesses that went on record one after another. The first guy was, I think his name was Scott Allen, and he was a pilot that witnessed this object that seemed to be about 4,000 feet wide. It had what appeared to be bright lights, would be almost afterburners behind it without flames as it was moving across the sky. But a variety of police officers were witnesses to this, went on record. There was an object that looked like a surfboard, had red lights on it. It was moving along usually slowly, and then it would speed up. So once again, thousands of witnesses to an event that occurred over a period of time in the Stephenville, Texas area outside of Dallas.
Yeah, the president, George W. Bush, had a ranch out there, and he was out there at the time.
Well, he wasn't at his ranch at the time.
Oh, he wasn't?
When it happened. He wasn't there, but these objects, they were certainly in restricted airspace because they were in a training area near the closest Air Force base there. Mm-hmm. And they had AWACS planes out there tracking it too. And this object came within 10 miles of George Bush's house in that area and then peeled off.
Well,
no chance chased it.
That would have to be restricted airspace, right?
Oh, it absolutely was. It absolutely was. It was also what was called an MOA area where they would do training, and that was absolutely restricted to just military aircraft.
And I'll bet they didn't answer their hail, did they?
No, not quite. At first, the military denied they had any jets in the area.
Yeah.
But in fact, Robert Powell, investigation, found out there were 10 jets in the area flying. Then they came back and said, oh, we looked at the wrong logbook. Yeah, there were 10 jets in the area.
So,
how come you didn't chase the object?
Yeah, right. In your book, you examine the unexplained abductions with the missing time events.
Yeah. There was it's always questionable when you have people talking about being abducted. It's a very sensitive subject, and mostly it's single witness. And once again, single witness saying they were abducted, going to a hypnotic regression session, and then trying to decipher reality from fantasy is really tough to believe. And I really shy away from the single witness cases. I focused more on was multiple witnesses that were involved in abduction. And one of my favorite, I have two I thought were outstanding. One was the Allagash abduction that occurred with four Boston art students January, I believe, 76. Or no, I'm sorry, it was August 76 up in the Allagash Upper Waterway of Maine, which was a five-day trip. They took it every year. And they had gone out. They were trying to, they don't take a lot of food with them because they expect to catch fish, and that becomes their main food that they eat for the 5 days. Well, they weren't having much luck, and they were doing daytime fishing, and they just couldn't seem to catch much of fish. They were getting a little concerned because they didn't have much food with them. So they said, well, let's try nighttime fishing. So they go out late at night. They build a giant bonfire. It's big enough where it should last about 3 hours in burning. It was a huge bonfire, big logs. So they go out, and they're not having any luck. And one of the guys in the boat, in the canoe, I should say, he turns around and he sees an object that appears to be rising up over the trees that surround the waterway. And it looks like the underside looks like four quadrants that look. He said he described it like roiling spaghetti sauce. I mean, it was like liquid moving around what appeared to be or something moving, a very reddish orange underneath this craft. And they're looking at it and they're like, what the heck is that? So one of them decides to And it's always happened. Sometimes a big mistake. He took his flashlight and he sent an SOS signal towards him.
Wow.
Bad move.
Yep.
Soon as he did that, the craft immediately ejected a large white beam onto the river and started moving towards him. Can you imagine how terrifying that must be? You got this craft, shoots down a white beam, and now the white beam and the craft are moving towards you. So they start hauling butt out of there, you know, back to shore, and they're paddling and paddling. And the next thing they remember is three of the gentlemen, two were brothers, Jim and Jack Weiner. They were identical twins. And so now three of them are out of the canoe on the shore, and one's still sitting in the canoe. And they look over and they see basically a kind of a classic looking flying saucer hovering above the waterway, very close, maybe 50 feet away, sitting on a beam of light. They said it was a beam of light coming down. It was almost like it was sitting on this white beam of light.
Mm-hmm.
And then they watched it take off in a step motion. I mean, what would happen is it would implode and then reappear, like as if it was an iris of a camera closing up and then reappearing in another part of the sky and then closing up and then reappearing in another part of the sky until it disappeared. So they stumble over to the picnic table, and when they look over and they notice that the embers, the big fire, were down to just dull embers. Now, remember, that was a fire that would have lasted anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours. They believe 15 minutes have gone by. But according to the fire, about 3 hours have gone by, 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit at the table. They have, they're mumbling, having, they're not really talking about what they saw. And they go to bed. Next day, they see a forest ranger. They tell him the story. The forest ranger thinks they're a bunch of drunks. He doesn't take them seriously, and he leaves. 12 years go by. So Jim Weiner is on his roof doing some work, falls off a ladder, hits his head, ends up with temporal epilepsy, starts having nightmares about alien beings surrounding his bed. And probing him, has the same nightmare every night. Tells his doctor, who apparently was interested in UFOs, tells him there was a UFO conference that was going to be happening in a couple of weeks in the Boston area. Says you should go to that. He goes, ends up wandering over to Ray Fowler, great investigator and author, and starts telling him a story. Fowler thinks he's crazy, tells him to leave. Then he comes back again, Jim Weiner, and he says, look, I'm telling you, me and my friends. And Fowler goes, wait, there were other people involved. He goes, yeah, I was with three other people. So began a 2-year investigation involved with hypnotic regression. And all four guys ended up telling the most fascinating story. They remembered the abduction. It was the only abduction that I ever read about that when they were put back in the canoe and they were up in the craft, one of the guys remembers actually being transported. He said, it felt like every atom in my body was being torn apart. And then I was back together again in a canoe. Like he remembered the actual transportation process going from the craft and being basically sent down to the canoe. They were down all placed in the canoe. There were some entities while they were up there, they were going through some classic medical exams that you read about all the time, abductions, skin scrapings, blood withdrawal, nail clippings, hair clippings. And they sat there totally naked on a bench with a alien entity with a very large head and very large eyes sitting at the end of the bench, just staring at them. And all three were just sitting, three of them would be sitting on the bench naked. One would be on a gurney in the examination. And Jim Weiner remembered his brother, Jack Weiner, being in the examination room on a table, watching this getting scanned or looked like some kind of device out of the ceiling that was scanning his body. And he wanted to help him, but he couldn't move. All he could do was sit there. He could see the entity staring at him. He could see his brother. He couldn't do anything about it. They all went through the exam. They were all placed back in the canoe. They all were able to verify each other's story. Once again, we're talking, you know, hypnotic regression, but it's pretty fascinating. One of them ended up with a gummy substance in their body and it got removed, looked like chewing gum. It was sent over to a lab at the Pentagon. Everything went dark on them. They couldn't get any information on what the substance that was removed from one of the guy's bodies.
No, they wouldn't.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah. It was looked like pink bubble gum inside his knee. It was very strange.
Inside,
So
inside his knee, you say?
Yeah, it was like scoped out of his he had some pain in his leg. It was scoped out of his leg. I think it was his leg. And but he never got the results back of what it was. And there was an event that took place in the same year. This one was in January of the same year, 76, in Kentucky. About three women who were coming back from a birthday party celebration. It was about 11 o'clock at night. They were driving from where they were to their hometown. It was about typically would have taken them somewhere around 40 minutes, somewhere in that area, or 30 minutes, about a 30-minute drive. They're driving home. They see an object, a red object in the sky. They think it's a plane about to crash, and they're watching. And all of a sudden, this object just swoops down right next to their car, fires a very bright bluish white beam into their car. The car is then dragged backwards onto a little gully area, and they could feel their eyes burning as this beam of light is pulling their car backwards. And then all of a sudden, the car takes off. Now, the interesting part about it is the car is now driving at 85 miles per hour, according to the speedometer. The only problem was the woman, first name was Louise, she is not stepping on the accelerator. She even shows her friend that she's not. She raises her foot up. She's not stepping the accelerator. The car is moving at 85 miles per hour, and it's a straight road. Well, the road that they were on is twisty-wanty. It doesn't have a straight bone in its body. But yet they look like, you know how when you take off on a runway and you see the white lights going by you at night as you started? That's what it looked like. It looked like lights of a runway going by. And that's all they really remember, until they go through a hypnotic regression session later on. And all three had a different experience. And it wasn't pleasant. They were basically one with, they was in a harness that moved her body parts, her arms and legs around as if they were testing her mobility. Another one was had like what seemed to be a noose around her neck. And if she tried to speak, the noose would tighten around her throat. And if she tried to think to speak, the noose would tighten around her throat.
Wow.
One woman said she was observing like a third party, another woman on a gurney, and she was watching this woman being examined. And she was thinking, well, I wonder if that's me and I'm just out of my body. Another woman felt a very, very hot like towel pressed in her face. She felt like she was suffocating. She felt like her face was burning, was in a lot of pain. And then one of the entities just kind of looked over at her, put his head down real close to her eyes, and boom, the pain went away. Mm. They all went through their examination. Another woman felt that she was at the bottom of a volcano looking out at the top of the opening. And she could see like a portal window where entities were walking by her. So Leo Sprinkle did the hypnotic regression session on these three women. He believes something definitely happened to him.
So all of this information they gave was under hypnosis, right?
Yeah. So with the part about remembering being pulled back in the white light, they all ended up with like, it looked like, felt like conjunctivitis of the eyes on there. So something caused their eyes to tear a lot. One of the women, her watch stopped working. Another woman, a woman there, her hour hand was moving at the speed of a second hand. the car was magnetized, being tested later, had a strong magnetic field around it. And then another strange little oddity was one of the women had a pet parakeet that loved her. And after this event occurred, when she went home and got near the cage, the parrot would jump away from her.
Oh.
So MUFON eventually got involved in the investigation. A guy named Jerry Black was the investigator for MUFON. And in that particular case, it's a long sort of story, but the National Enquirer was involved. So what happened was the National Enquirer got involved with funding the investigation. They started doing it independently. It was getting really expensive. Jerry Black called the National Enquirer. Bob Pratt was a journalist there. Bob Pratt ends up becoming writing the article, but it was the National Enquirer. But Bob Pratt happened to be a great journalist who happened to work for the National Enquirer. But when they would get near the parakeet, nothing would happen. But when this particular woman that owned it, that went through this event, would walk near the stage, the parrot would just go berserk. Eventually, the parrot died 30 days later.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you explain that? You don't.
So, yeah, I mean, it was just very strange. They really didn't. They were just, you know, mortified about the attention they were getting. You know, they agreed to having the National Choir fund it, but all this attention, it just, and they were all losing weight, weren't eating, and they were just sick to their stomach about the whole thing. But they clearly had marks on their body. They had the conjunctivitis of the eye, and they all supported. And by the way, when they got right after the event occurred, they went home, they immediately told a neighbor about something. They saw a UFO. And something weird happened, and the neighbor immediately separated them and had them all sketch what they saw, and it was all identical. It was pretty smart of that neighbor to have them immediately sketch what they saw to support the physical object.
We need to take one more break just to remind our listeners you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Barry Roth, he's author and UFO investigator. We only have about 10 minutes left, Barry, but I wanted to ask you, back in 1950, a literal armada of UFOs were seen by multiple witnesses in Farmington, New Mexico. Can you tell us a little bit about that incident?
Yeah, that was probably one of the first notorious mass witness sightings. Farmington. I mean, there was over 600 people that witnessed this event. It primarily took place over, realistically, it was 3 days, but the middle day was the most sighted day, in that there were hundreds of objects seen flying in the sky back and forth in a certain rhythm. Sometimes it would fly towards each other and then fly away. They would fly over each other, but it was literally hundreds of objects seen in the sky. The mayor was a witness, radio station, newspapers, military, tons of witnesses. David Marlowe did a good job bringing that to light over. He lives at the National UFO Historical Record Center. He's in Albuquerque. And no photos, unfortunately, that ever came out of it.
What year was this? 1950. 1950s. Why weren't there photos?
It's amazing. There was one photo that claimed to be a photo of the objects, but during a deep dive investigation by Dave Marler, it turned out it was a photo of some objects in Australia. It had nothing to do with Farmington, New Mexico. So not one photo could be found, at least, of this event. But variety of witnesses. It was triangulated by one guy saying they were moving up to 1,000 miles per hour. He had nothing that could move that fast in 1950 at 1,000. I think the fastest plane could move probably about 450 miles per hour. So there was evidence of these objects moving around. One cop who was there said, oh, it was cotton flying in the air. Well, it wasn't cotton flying throughout the air, you know, cotton weed and things like that. So, but yeah, there was a one gentleman was supposed to be interviewed on a radio station about the sightings that occurred on the main day of that in 1950. And then the radio station was contacted by, I believe it was the military, saying, do not interview this guy or we'll pull your license. Mm-hmm. So the interview never happened.
Well, that was similar to Roswell when they came out with, yeah, we got one of those flying discs, and it was announced it got one of those flying discs, and then the next thing you know, that was just a weather balloon. A weather balloon.
Yeah, initially, Walter Haught was told to go ahead and release the press release by Rainey, General Rainey, but later it was said, no, we don't want this information to be released, so we're just going to say, fascinating story. And I try to summarize Roswell in 7 pages in there, because my book is basically a high level extract. So instead of reading, I want to read about this event, I'm going to read 300 pages on it. I'm saying my book covers 85 events with a very brief high level extract. It's anywhere from a half a page, you know, to the longest being Roswell, 7 pages. The average probably event there is about 2 pages long, with just an extract. But I want to mention, I know we don't have much time left, but one of the key things I always find fascinating is the politics of UFOs. is that how do we get to be so skeptical? And really, it was the greatest public relations campaign ever in the United States that occurred. You know, instead of being curious about potentially sentient life visiting our planet, we became skeptical and laughed at people that talked about UFOs. And there was a reason why that happened. It started with the Robertson panel in 1953 during the last days of the Truman presidency to put together a panel to investigate these, you know, pesky UFOs that were flying around. And they were told to, later on it was found out, they were told to look at the, there was five scientists on the panel, H.P. Robertson led it, but they were told to look it through the lens of defense and security. You got scientists. They weren't even looking at through the lens of science. They were looking through defense and security. And at the end, I mean, they had 2,331 Air Force UFO cases to investigate. They investigated 23.1% out of all that. They did it over a four-day period. And if they broke down the hours they spent on the investigation, it was 12 hours. They spent 12 hours over 4 days investigating 23 cases and changed the course of history. Mm-hmm. I mean, to put in perspective, the Tremont case in Utah where Delbert Newhouse filmed for 47 seconds, like 30 UFOs, that film was examined for 1,000 hours. These guys spent 12 hours investigating 23 cases and totally changed the course of history, basically saying that it was a waste of time to investigate every UFO report. There was no evidence of a direct threat to national security, and it was agreed and recommended that the aura of mystery that these UFOs have created, unfortunately acquired, has to be dismissed. Hmm. And it was a full campaign to go out there to, if you can't discredit the witness, I'm sorry, if you can't discredit the evidence, discredit the witness. Right. Now, there was concerns at the time, you know, granted, we were coming out of the Korean War, entering into a Cold War with the Soviet Union at the time. And there was concern about psychological warfare, that if people kept reporting UFOs, it would be a logjam of communications that would backlog things so badly that we wouldn't be able to keep up with all the UFO reports coming, because it would be Russian agents phoning in every hour a UFO report. It would create the logjam. It would be a really basically hostile propaganda that was being used against the United States to create hysterical behavior and, most importantly, a distrust of our authority, that we can't be protected. Our military can't protect us because the Russians are flying objects into restricted airspace and they're moving at such speed that we can't do anything about it. So I get why they were concerned about it. And they created, though, a whole media effort to discredit UFOs. It was followed up by the Condon Committee, because you had Sign, Grudge, Blue Book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Blue Book started off with all great intentions, you know, certainly in how they approached ufology and how they were going to investigate it based on doing a benchmark of lighting. Of if you had unusual lights in the sky, you'd have a lighting spectrum analysis being examined. There was always these great ideas of how they were going to you know, approach that. But at the end of the day, the Air Force wanted out of the UFO business. Yeah. So, and the instigation of this, David, was actually took place in your state, Michigan.
Really?
It was actually the Swamp Gas
event
that occurred. That was the catalyst that led to the O'Brien Committee saying we need to put together a university study, an independent study of UFOs. And they, but they had done such a good job of discrediting anybody that investigated UFOs that when they went to MIT, MIT said, we're not touching this with a 10-foot pole. They went to Harvard. Harvard said, we're not going to investigate it. They went to the University of North Carolina, went to the University of California. They all backed away. It was only because of the National Atmospheric program that was taking place in Colorado, that was a sister university, in essence, to the University of Colorado, that they backed into accepting the program. And ultimately, Edward Condon became the head of the program of investigating UFOs. And it started off, you know, they were paying $300,000. They thought that was good money. They ended up paying $525,000 to the for the investigation by the University of Colorado. that took place over a 2-year period. But the Air Force, and it was a CIA sponsored investigation, they, whatever funding it took to come up with the, in quotes, proper conclusion is what they were looking for. They wanted out of the UFO business. They don't care what it took. Compton already had his mind made up before the actual 2-year investigation became involved, that there was this whole program investigating doesn't make sense. It's a waste of time. But he wasn't supposed to come up to that conclusion until 2 years from now. And the end result was the end of Project Blue Book. The Air Force finally got what they wanted. Government stopped investigating UFOs, at least public facing. But we know with that kind of potential national security threat, they were never going to stop investigating UFOs, even though they said no UFO was a threat to our national security. There was nothing flying out there from a technological standpoint that we didn't already have. And there was no evidence that any UFOs were a representation of extraterrestrial life. That part's true. We still don't have evidence to prove it's ET, but there's enough anecdotal evidence out there in trace cases and radar cases that we can say it's unconventional. It's not terrestrial.
No, but wouldn't you rather it be extraterrestrial or other dimensional than to be Russian or Chinese?
Exactly.
They've admitted what's
the bigger threat would be domestic.
That's it.
Yeah.
They've admitted it's not us. It's not U.S.
Right. It's the only reason why now that we're at least have the task force that got involved, and now we have ARRW, the All Domain Anomalous Resource Office, that will now, theoretically examine. Of course, their last report that came out from ARRW was a big giant joke, that 32-page report that basically was inaccurate. Mm-hmm. Anything from where they had wrong dates. They said Kenneth Arnold's sighting was on June 23rd, 1947, was June 24th, 1947. I mean, they could have gone to Wikipedia to look that up. I mean, we're paying all this money. We're not even getting accurate information on there. But look, where disclosure is going to happen when our government says it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's right. I always say disclosure will happen when ET decides it's going to happen. So we don't know. But do you have a website, Barry?
You know, I don't on there. I still work full time, my paying job. So I haven't had a chance to really do more of a deep dive into my own website. I do get asked that. That's something that will happen when I retire. In the meantime, I'm kind of working on another book, which is more about what I started to allude to at the end, is the politics of UFOs. What happens with the Robertson panel? What happened with the Condon Committee, Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book? How do we get to where we are of being so skeptical about UFOs when we should be so curious and amazed? And my God, wouldn't that be the greatest discovery in humankind, that we're not alone?
And where can people go to check out your book?
Well, then go to Amazon on there. They can look up Barry Roth, or just, A Brief History of Ufology. As you mentioned, 1941 to 2008, subtitle part of that is Significant UFO Events Throughout the Modern Era. And once again, I focus more on the most credible cases, single witness cases. I only had one single witness case, and that was an alleged abduction by a Nebraska police officer in the 50s. Because this guy had nothing to gain by telling his story. And also Leo Sprinkle got involved in the analysis and the hypnotic regression session. But I focus on military intrusions, pilot sightings, mass witness, physical trace cases like the Delphos, Kansas case in 1971.
Okay. Well, Barry Roth, thank you so much for joining us. And best of luck with your book project. Okay.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for having me on, David. I appreciate it and hope your audience enjoys the content.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button. Then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.